You're listening to Rendezvous with a Writer with Bobby Jean and Jim Bell, only on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to Rendezvous with a Writer, where readers and writers meet,
and story is everything.
We're your hosts tonight, Jim and Bobby Bell. You've just been listening to the Hot Texas, Swing Band, our friend Alex Dormont, and
welcome to episode 126. We have two phenomenal guests with us tonight. We can't wait to get to them, and we're going to bring them on right now. Say hello to Richard Sherry, author of A Month of Sundays. Hello, Richard. Hello. And joining Richard is Frank Weber, coming back, I think, for a third time. Hello, Frank. And we're going to be talking about his book, The Sun. Oh, my goodness.
Thank you, Jim and Bobby, for having me on.
You know, gentlemen, both of these books had us on the edge of our chairs. And my suggestion, as you're listening or watching the rest of the show, is if you like political thrillers, you're in the right place. If you like true crime, you're in the right place. If you're saying to yourself, you know, that's not my genre, you need to be in this place, because you broadened your reading horizons. And these are two gentlemen that will get you interested in new genres. And you need to do that, don't you?
Right.
You can only read so many of any genre before they're just kind of, you know, the same, right?
You can never read. This genre probably can't never read too much.
You can't.
Up to date. We got thrillers. What can I say? Can't.
So first off, Richard, where are you joining us from tonight?
I'm from Peoria, Arizona, which is a suburb of Phoenix.
Okay. And let's see, is spring springing there? Are you already getting hot temps and such, or what's going on?
We just had a lovely rainstorm. It'll be in the 80s tomorrow.
And I know a lot of our author friends are heading to Tucson this weekend for both Tombstone on Friday for the Tombstone Festival of Books, and then into Tucson for the Tucson Book Festival. So sounds like they got great weather coming.
Yes.
Now, Mr. Frank Weber, where are you joining us from today?
I'm in Piers, Minnesota. It's northern Minnesota, and we're supposed to get some snow tomorrow.
Very good. All right. I think we're supposed to get a lot of wind.
We're supposed to get snow. It's wind here in Albuquerque. Well, we are delighted to have you both joining us. And Frank is staying on totally, but we're going to kind of spend a little bit of time with Richard to talk about his book. And Frank, we're hoping that you'll just jump in or ask a question or feel free to have a little dialogue with Richard. There's something magical when authors get to speak to each other.
Oh, yeah.
Isn't there? There really is.
They won't even need us.
No, we'll just be able to sit back and listen. Isn't that fun? Yeah. So, Richard, before we start, Jim has a little something to welcome you with.
A little bio. Okay. Rich Sherry is a retired college professor and administrator who taught and worked in administration at two evangelical colleges. Married to Candy Scherer for 47 years, he met and married Marjorie Matheson Hance after Cindy's death from the effects of dementia. He brings the places he has lived, Washington, New York, Illinois, Kentucky, Minnesota, and Arizona, into his novels. He has written a memoir and three novels of political intrigue and is working on his fourth. Welcome, Richard.
Thank you. Good to be here.
We are so happy to have you. So tell us, maybe expand a little bit on that background and tell us how it touched writing. How did you and writing get to know each other?
Well, I am a college English professor, back in my history. And when you mentioned earlier some of the books that Frank has brought into his books, I taught some of those books. So it's really fun to hear that they're in Frank's books as well. I began writing this sort of after retirement or getting to retirement in pieces for Facebook about how I was working with Candy as she went through dementia. And that's the basis of the book that I wrote, The Long Run, which is about her 11 years from diagnosis until death. And it's a difficult story. When she passed away a few months later, Margie and I met, and we began talking about writing. She was in the middle of writing her first novel. Mm-hmm. So shortly after that, we got caught up in COVID, and then I started working on A Month of Sundays as she was working on her second novel by that time.
The inspiration for A Month of Sundays. Yeah. How did that come about? That's very interesting.
Yeah.
Well, I think it started again during COVID, but we had been seeing so many narratives from the left and from the right and from the center about what was actually happening in the country. It was difficult to get a sense of who was telling the truth. And the longer you listen, the more you realize that people are pushing us as Americans in particular directions to vote or to agree with certain policies, to support them. And it's both Democrats and Republicans are doing this. And what I decided to do is there a way for somebody to get access to what's really happening? And for instance, the emails of every senator. Now in 2022, we had 34 Senate seats up for grabs. And so I thought, what if I had somebody who could get into those emails and then get them out to every voter state by state, Sunday by Sunday, over the course of months as we came into the primaries and then the election. So that's where the Month of Sundays came in. You know, a Month of Sundays is usually a phrase that describes something that's long and boring. Well, I wanted to make every Sunday not boring at all for states from Alaska right on down through the alphabet. So that's where that came from. Somebody who wanted to find out what's really happening and put it on the table, no way to cover up who owns your senator, who influences your senator.
Right. And it's gripping because our Dr. Baker, and you know, he's at the readers, we get to see kind of how it's happening and how it's unfolding. The general public, of course, do not. But we know from the beginning that one of your characters, Dr. Baker, is really the visionary behind this. And he has a person that helps him figure out the software to be able to do it, doesn't he? Who does? Tell us a little bit about how he gathers. I don't think it's a spoiler alert. Tell us a little bit about how he finds his way to do this.
And if readers get as far as chapter 3, they're going to find out how he gets the information. So it's not a spoiler at all. He works with a colleague from the college that he just retired from. And the colleague is a software guy who is really good at intrusion and hacking and so forth because he teaches his students about cybersecurity. So he helps Baker by developing a program that once it's uploaded into a computer, will go to every computer that original computer has contact with. So if you've got a secretary in an office who sends out an email, the program goes out with the email. And once it's on somebody else's computer, then it goes to every other computer on the network. So Baker ends up with a huge amount of data coming from lobbyists and legislators. Eventually we find out the Supreme Court is involved, the executive branch, the Republican, the Democratic Party, and all this information comes back to Baker, who then has to sort it and send it out to the appropriate states for them to react to.
So I have a question, Richard. Is Dr. Baker an insider, or is he someone who wants to fix a system and gets help to do so?
He's retired from college teaching, and he's an outsider.
Okay.
He's a political science professor. who has worked in D.C. with students who have been interns, and that's his vector. That's the way he goes to get it. But he's an outsider.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. When we say on this show, story is everything, gentlemen, both of your stories is everything. Mm-hmm. Now, Richard, again, early in the book, when we have all the emails. So if mm-hmm. I were somebody that he was going to send an email to in the sender line, what name do I see in the sender line when it comes into me?
Oh, it would originally, the original ones go to his interns in D.C. And he's sending them week by week a letter about asking what's going on with their internship. And he sends a picture on campus. And this is actually a real thing. There's a way to embed a piece of code in a picture that you get on your computer. And over time, as Baker sends pictures from campus, the program is being built up. So they think it's from him, and it is. But once the program assembles itself, then it's going to go out with the subject line of whoever sent it. It'll look like a real letter, but it's actually got this virus in it that is going to make contact across the network.
Yeah, and I think it's a Month of Sundays group is in the line, and then he sends it to the New York Times, the U.S. News Desk, the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post Politicals Desk, the Seattle Post Intelligencer, the Washington Desk, the L.A. Times, and the Denver Post. And these organizations all get it
right
at the same time.
Yes, and when he's sending it out, when he's sending all the data out to these groups, it's from the Month of Sundays group, which really is just Dr. Baker, but you know, he's creating this image that is much more widespread and a larger group than it really is.
Yeah. So when we were reading this book, we kept saying to each other, we better be careful about what we put in our emails.
Careful about that. Yeah,
we won't want anything to come back to haunt us.
Yeah, when we were talking the other night, I mentioned the three-star general that was sending emails out, and he was getting himself in trouble because he had a mistress, and his entire life was starting to unravel because he didn't know that his emails were really private.
This just happened. I mean, this is real.
It's real stuff.
This is real news.
There are a lot of people, probably even today, there's a lot of people that don't realize you think you send out an email, nobody knows about it. And you say, okay, I'm gonna erase it. I'm gonna trash it. There's no problem. No. They never seem to go away.
And he has like 10 years worth of data.
Yes, he gets an awful lot of data from sort of dead drops that he's got set up. Computers all around the country, send him the package of mail when he commands it. But then there's another trick to it, too, and that is that he has, with his friend Eric's help, he has figured out a way that when the data comes to him, the program erases itself. So you never know where the data has been. And if you go to the computer and look for it, there's just a big hole there and no sense of what the computer was, what the program was that created it. So he takes a lot of caution to be anonymous in the face of this, as Jim was mentioning, an email is forever. So you have to figure out how to clean up your tracks as much.
Note to self, we should see.
Well, we use emails and texts for prosecuting cases all the time.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and it's also interesting that he's certainly doing something somewhat illegal because he's getting into people's, computers, but there's no security. There's no national security issues. He's not looking for things that could label this group a terrorist group or, so you're very careful as the author to control really what is he looking at and what are some of the consequences that he's hoping might happen. He doesn't know what will happen, right, Richard?
No, he doesn't. And he wants to try to create change and the space for change, because people will be forced to confront what they have actually given themselves to. You know, if you're supporting a group that is violent, now we're going to know it. If you're supporting a group because they will fund your campaign, we'll know that too. But Baker, you know, Baker's a Christian. He's concerned about ethical issues. He knows he's breaking the law. He doesn't want to bring his students into it if he can help it. So he stays away from national security. He doesn't reveal financial documents or accounts or anything like that. But he is breaking the law. There are cybersecurity laws that he is definitely breaking. And naturally, the FBI is a little concerned about this.
Just a little.
Well, you point out that when we vote for somebody, we think we're getting somebody that's going to do what we kind of like to see done. But we find out there's other people involved that kind of take over, and our vote really doesn't mean too much.
Well, I think our votes do mean a lot, but we have to hold our senators and our congressmen accountable after the fact. You know, if we as a group or individuals are recommending policies for change or saying don't do that, don't go there, and they do, then we have to hold them accountable. Mm-hmm. And that means maybe protest, certainly means letters. It means assuring them that next time you're not getting my vote. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't feel like a lot of leverage, but corporately it means a lot. And I think Baker, that's what Baker is hoping for. And I think we see some results of that too in the book.
You know, it was kind of interesting in reading the reaction of the folks at the newspapers, the editors, you know, the publishers, and it's kind of like, wow, what is this information? What are we going to do with it?
Yeah. And they actually...
Do we sit on it, or are we...
They actually kind of talk to each other about it, which is a surprise. But they're realizing that this is more than just a story, that there's a, you know, there could be a Pulitzer Prize in there for them.
Or a bunch of them, yeah. Yeah. Or you could go to jail.
Right. Well, and I think, Richard, it sounds like you're doing a great job dealing with the dilemmas. Once we start something, we don't have any control over how it plays out.
Yeah.
You know,
one of the failures of imagination politically, and we're seeing it in this administration, we've seen it in other administrations, is that people aren't asking the question, what will happen next? If we do something, what will happen next?
Yeah.
And Frank, you're exactly right. The consequences really need to be on people's minds, and often they're not.
Gentlemen, you both write a series. How do you, this is kind of a question for both of you, how do you keep a series lively and fresh for yourself as the writer of the series and with your reader in mind? Frank, do you want to take a stab at that first?
Sure. I think part of it is I'm excited about writing it. You know, that... And I get an idea for the next, this is where I want to go with this. This is the next direction. And I think that comes out in your writing, that if someone feels the writing gets stale, then your writing gets stale. You know, that you have to, it has to be something you're excited about doing. And I like writing as characters develop, but that's why it's fun for me having the characters, main characters based on my wife and I and the relationship, because you're aware, if you're in a relationship, how people change over time.
Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah. And Rich, what about you? You've written, this is just the first book in the series. So tell us about that.
Well, when I started, and I think it's probably true for Frank too, when I started, I had a pretty small cast. I had Baker and a few friends and some antagonists who come in. But the second book, Mondays, I realized, as I was finishing up a month of Sundays, that I dealt with the legislative branch. But we also have the judicial branch, the Supreme Court in particular, and we have the executive branch, which became First Tuesday. And you realize that the government is a lot of people trying to do a good job and some bad apples in there. But you have to sort of sort out, is there a place to address this particular issue, say the judiciary, which I do with the Supreme Court. I think keeping it fresh to pick up on what Frank said. One of the things that I did in both of these books is Baker's still a primary character, but I begin with another character. So in Mondays, I start out with a Supreme Court Justice, Thomas Accardi, who is really unhappy because he realizes that some of the things he's been supporting for the last 15 years are not doing people good, but are doing people harm. And so he has a crisis of conscience there early, chapter one or chapter two, and he is a way into what's going on in the Supreme Court and has been, I think, for 20 years or so. The third book, First Tuesday, I begin with the character of, at that time, the former president, who is making a comeback, trying to make a comeback. And you get a look into his eyes and how the world looks through his eyes. So I think that shift in perspective and then the sort of shift sideways into a different branch of government has helped me keep it fresh.
We have something in common, the three or four of us, and that is Blue Cottage Agency, as well as being fans of each other's and readers and writers of all types and all genres. And if you also are a writer, find out what Blue Cottage Agency can do for you. They are multi-talented, Blue Cottage Agency and Clicks by Madison. And let me see, I want to make sure I say everything I want to say here. Find out what they could do for you. And we want to thank them for being sponsors of Rendezvous with a Writer and for everything that they do for their writers. In a moment, we're going to hear a word from them, and then Richard will stay on the line with us, but we'll be shifting to look at an in-depth look with Frank Weber of his newest story in his series, The Sun. We'll be right back. Rendezvous with a Writer is sponsored by Blue Cottage Agency and Clicks by Madison, your author publicity and book marketing team. Experience, trusted, effective. Contact them today at bluecottageagency.com.
Welcome back to Rendezvous with a Writer. We were just talking with Richard Sherry and his book of A Month of Sunday. And now we're going to switch to Frank, which I've been switching. And we're going to talk about his book, latest book, The Sun.
I just want to comment that both Krista Sukup and Janelle Madison really do a great job. They're excellent. Yeah. Blue Cottage.
Yeah. So, yeah. Thank you. They sure do. They're so creative, aren't they?
Yes, they are.
I just never know what they're going to come up with, and it's always exciting.
Right. They know a lot about business. So.
Yeah, they sure do. Well, let's see. Frank is returning to be with us, but in case you haven't been able to be with us his two other times, Jim's going to give you a little something
bio
about Frank.
Yeah. Frank F. Weber is a forensic psychologist specializing in homicide, sexual assault, and domestic abuse cases. He uses his unique understanding of how predators think, knowledge of victim trauma, and expert testimony in writing his true crime thrillers. Frank has been interviewed on investigative shows and profiled cold case homicides. His novels have earned numerous awards. Frank is a 2024 recipient of the Outstanding Achievement Award for the Minnesota Psychological Association, and he received the President's Award from the Minnesota Correctional Association for his forensic work. Glad to have you, Frank.
It's great to be here. Thanks, Jim and Bobby.
Oh, my goodness, The Sun. And I can see a big poster behind you. For those that are just listening to audio, I see a poster of Scandal of Vandals. How does it connect to this new book, Frank?
Okay. So about a year ago, Scandal of Vandals and The Sun was one thick book. And I sent it to Kirkus for a review because they do real critical reviews. And I wanted to hear what they said. And they said, you have a great story. The problem is it's two books. And after I thought about it, I thought, well, there's a great division because halfway through the book, at the end of Scandal of Vandals, it ends with a conviction. The Sun begins with an appeal. And so if you read Scandal of Vandals, you wouldn't know that there's another story following it with all the same characters. And the whole story came out of, it originated from the T. Eugene Thompson case that happened in Minnesota back in the 1960s. He was a famous attorney, one of the most famous in the United States. He was going to be on the cover of Life magazine, who was accused of hiring a hitman to kill his wife. And at one point was called the crime of the century. And their son, Jeff Thompson, who's now a judge, met with me and asked me to write the story. And so as we got talking about it, I said, I'd love to write this story, but I want to write it in the modern era. And so I can pull in current events and contemporary happenings. And I also want to talk a little about how, you know, the laws have changed and play that into it, I think would be interesting. And Jeff and I had a number of conversations of it. Eventually I gave him Scandal of Vandals to read and he was very happy. He said, you nailed the characters perfectly. And so then we went to the son afterward.
So in this book, one of our main characters is Tug. He has a different name.
T-U-G, and, that's what I have. Yep.
Yeah. And oh, he's despicable. In fact, Frank,
yes.
This book has a large cast of characters and they're mostly despicable. They're underhanded. Nope. They're kind of filled with charisma and there's something, you know, that draws you to them, but they're just terrible people.
Right. And that's why the original book was Scandal of Vandals, because as we got talking about it, there were so many unsavory people involved in the whole situation.
Unsavory. That's the word.
And the sad thing is Deb, the person who gets murdered, was very sweet, very nice person.
Right. Yeah. I know you're sitting eager to say something to Frank.
Well, it's kind of interesting. You know, what I notice about the characters, the way you create them, they're bad guys. They're actually bad girls. But you kind of give them a sense of humor, which I always notice. So we're reading about these guys, and except for Tug, it's kind of, even he's got a sense of humor, but he's really not very nice any place in the story. Mm-hmm. But we got a guy by the name of Roan.
Oh.
Right.
You know, he's a mafia guy.
Yeah.
And the rest of them, he's got a wife who's actually, you know, in the mob, and very close to the Genovese crime family. And you read about what they're going on, and you think, well, I think, you know, what they did is bad, but not too bad, except for Tug, of course. Yeah. So when you write these things, that you know, you can kind of read about these folks, and they don't set you off too much, you know?
Right. Well, it kind of reminds me, sometimes I tell people, we're never as good and we're never as bad as we think we are.
Yeah.
And that's how, and the reality is, from doing all these assessments that I do, you realize good people are usually good. They're not always perfect. And bad people are usually bad, but sometimes they do things that surprise people.
Uh-huh. Yeah. That's true. And
what's interesting about Tug, and I we had this conversation before about, I talk about his, that Tug had a superpower. And in a sense, his superpower was the fact that everybody knew he was a liar, but he was able to convince any one person that he wasn't lying to you. And that's how everything, you know, he's having an affair with his secretary, he's having an affair with his law clerk, he's cheating on his wife, and nobody believes it. You know, even in the end, when he marries this multimillionaire woman, and in his demise, you know, she doesn't allow the kids to go to the funeral as family because they thought their dad was guilty, and she didn't believe it, you know, that everything is... You know.
Well, and he has Tatum.
Right.
Talk to us about Tatum.
She's an interesting character.
She's a really interesting character.
Right. And
Right.
And that's what was one of the interesting things about this story is, so he's having an affair with this law clerk who's a very attractive, tall blonde. And she eventually becomes his attorney. Okay. And so all of my book cover people are people who actually look like people from the story. And so when I divided into two books, I called the photographer. I said, I need to get a tall blonde for the cover of this book. And she said, well, you should call Jenny Brenny. She was on the cover of my very first book, Murder Book, back in 2017. And I said, I haven't talked to her for 7 years. And so I said, I'm not even sure I have a right number. So I texted her and asked her if she'd be interested in doing another cover. And she texted back right away. So I'd love to. That was a lot of fun. And then I thought, well, maybe I had a caller because the cover is a little more risque than my other covers. She's laying on the floor, just covered in a sheet. And so I thought, I should tell you about this is what it's going to look like. I said, obviously, you don't have to be undressed underneath it, but it's going to look like you are. And she said, no, I'm sure you'll do it classy. I don't have any worries about it. And she said, how soon do you want it done? I said, I was thinking in the next week or two because the book's ready to get going. And she says, well, that's a little soon. I said, no, because it's almost done because the way it was written. And she said, well, I'm in the hospital having a baby. And I said, I am so sorry for calling you. I never would have called her. I hadn't talked to her for 7 years. I had no idea where she was.
So funny. This book has, and I know as you've shared, it's based on a true yes. crime. But as it unfolds, we have that story.
Yes.
But we have other subplots going on. Are some of those plots, Frank, also based on true crimes, but not yes. that crime? Yes. Okay. Yes. You have a wonderful way of really pulling in other storylines. Right. And right. we have a variety of despicable people and groups right. that find their way in. Would you take a moment and tell us, where does the term made man come from?
Yeah, we were kicking that
yeah,
around.
And yeah, because right. it's a term we've all heard, but it has kind of an important
right, right. role in this book. Well, and it became real significant in the story because, you know, that there's an attempted kidnapping on a made man's spouse. And that's one of the rules in the mafia. A made man is someone who, by experience and by approval of all the mafia bosses, nobody can go after. And that, as a matter of fact, going after a made man is punishable by death. That you just, that's a rule you can't break. Mm-hmm. And so it is interesting. And to me, well, as I got talking to the son, you know, to Eugene's son about this whole story, Jeff, is, like I said, a scandal of vandals. There's so many people that you have his mom and dad go to McAllister College together, and they have this friend, Roan, who goes to college with him. And after college, Roan marries into the Minnesota Mafia and kills somebody. This is all true. And gets Tug for his attorney, who gets him off on a technicality. And then they said there's going to be some vindication that they expect to get for this. And this all happens right before this murder. And then you have Tug, who is, you know, having a couple affairs, has his wife insured for the equivalent of $10 million today. So there's a lot of motive there, who says, okay, I had thought about it, but I changed my mind. Then he had taken her on vacation out west and to LA and Washington, and people who saw him thought they were really in love. And so it's an interesting story.
Yeah.
Well, you know, you bring in other factions. We got the mafia involved. Right. But you got local gangs, yeah. I guess one called right. the Disciples, and they kind of have their own turf, so they kind of had to work together
right.
to some degree.
Right.
And we have a great chase scene with a Tesla.
Yes. Yes. Well, and yeah, just the research on it, that they make a car, you know, that goes in excess of 200 miles an hour is kind of ridiculous when there's no roads you can really drive it on outside of a racetrack.
Yeah. But, yeah. Yeah, and that the highway at very last moment and moving very fast, they put down a spike, right. whatever the prop strip or whatever that's called,
right.
just to try to, you know, stop that Tesla. And I thought, wow, people were really moving fast because that car is, you know, like you right. said, he's
going. We got one interesting thing. We can't say too much about him and the bad guy driving the Tesla, but you know, I'm seeing it unfold as you write the story, and I'm thinking, he's going 180 miles an hour. You know, the average guy doesn't know what to do at 180 yeah, miles right. an hour. Right. If you're not a race car driver, you know, it's going to be a bad right. hit.
Right, right, right. Yeah. That's why I start, you know, the whole book at with the Shakespeare quote, "These violent delights have violent ends," because that's the reality of how it all played out in the end.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we do have violence throughout, but some of it is you kind of go like, good.
Yeah.
You had that coming.
Yeah, yes.
You have an interesting character by the name of Ricky. And he's kind of a guy that, to me, he went down a path sort of by accident. Now, he's a bad guy. He's whacked a few people. But in the end, you find out that maybe they deserve it.
And he's not a bad guy.
Well, yeah. it's actually true to the case that this Ricky Day, at 16, killed his family. And he had a very abusive father. And it's a sad scenario. But what I thought was interesting, Tug actually defended him on his release from prison. And the dad, Jeff, I'm sorry, didn't even know about it. The son didn't even. So I told him all about that scenario. I was aware of it. He wasn't aware of it.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, and that person was released again right before the murder. But then Ricky was, you know, he went on to be a very loving and caring Christian and spent the rest of his life trying to make up for what he did by helping out the homeless and everybody.
Yeah.
And so different. And what I loved about the story is I got talking to son about it is that you have this person, Ricky, who commits this horrible crime that everybody wants him executed for. And he goes to prison, does his time, and he becomes a wonderful Christian and his attorney becomes a psychopath. That's the reality of it, you know.
Well, and then you have, of course, because it is a large cast of characters, we have a character that shows up a couple of times, Agnes Shrout. How do you say her last name?
Shrout, yes.
Shrout. And then there's that scene with the dumps, the concrete mixer. Yes. And but how does she play into the story?
Well, there's a woman I know who's a cantankerous elderly woman, and I just thought perfect character. So I use her periodically in my book and to have people stay with her occasionally when they're in the metro area. And because I really think if you want a good thriller, you can't have it intense all the time, every moment. I think that you have to lighten it up and then let people laugh a little bit and let people relax.
Breathe.
Right. And I always bring up to me the best example of it is Homeland, which is I like Claire Danes. She's a great actress. But the last season, I stopped watching it because it got boring because she was just frantic all the time. And that gets boring. There's no change, you know, that there has to be, you have to let the audience relax a little and you have to set up, you know, the thrill, the anticipation. Like I always liked Alfred Hitchcock talking about the thrill isn't in the gore, it's in the anticipation. And that's how I write. I truly believe that.
Yeah.
You know, you used her to introduce a subject in the book, Agnes. We're introducing the Medicare fraud. Right. Interesting enough, we got the mafia involved.
Right. And that Medicare fraud scandal did happen in Minnesota. Yeah.
Yeah,
it just tells you that the mob is in everything all the time.
Right. Well, they look opportunities to make easy money. You know, that's.
Okay. Now, before we stop for a very brief ad, Frank, I need to ask about a couple of locations. And again, when we spoke the other night, I was about halfway through the book and then I couldn't put it down. I had to do nothing today until I had finished it. But you take us into, the Mall of America. Who knew? What's it famous for besides shopping?
Right. The most common place people commit suicide in Minnesota.
Who knew?
Who would have known that one?
Yeah. Right. Because it's access. You have access to a 7-story parking ramp. You know that?
Yeah. Yeah. And then you took us into a very scary moment with the caves. And I'm not sure I'm calling that.
The Wabasha Caves, yes.
Yeah. Yes. Have you, I'm assuming you've been there.
I have been there, yes.
Richard, have you been there? You call Minnesota home?
Okay.
Okay. Scary place.
Right. The mafia used to, from all over the world, you know, all the famous mobsters back in the 1930s would come there. There was a hideout and they had like a restaurant, they had a casino, all in this cave system. Yeah. And the story I tell there is actually a true story where a waitress at one point heard Tommy guns go off and there's three guys dead sitting at a table with poker chips in front of them. They called the St. Paul police. They asked her to step outside. 2 hours later, They come back and confront her and say, we shouldn't make up lies like this. You could get charged with making a false report. She goes back in. The whole place is cleaned up. But still to this day, you can see the bullet holes in the wall.
Yeah. Yeah.
Richard, do you have a question for Frank?
I do. Frank, like as I was saying, as we got started, I just started the I-94 murders. Mm-hmm. And I noticed that you're anchoring your scenes by time, a date, and place pretty carefully. Is that something you do consistently throughout your books?
I do through all my books. I and that's part of my own obsessiveness. You know, working as a forensic psychologist, that's what you're doing all the time, is you're noting, okay, this is where I was at this time, and this, you know, that.
And I do, Bobby G asked me about this the other night, that I do that in part because to add the sense of realistic movement in time and space, you know, my character Baker travels from Minnesota to Arizona, mm-hmm. and you know it's going to take you a couple of days to do that, and
right.
and so you try to make it the kind of transitions that are realistic for characters as well. You anchor them in a setting, and then it's easier to make that very believable.
That's a really good comment, Richard, because I also think that. It does. It brings a sense of realness to the reader that, mm-hmm. okay, here's the report. This is what's happening.
Yeah.
And in Frank's book, we have multiple voices. And so, right. and you do preface in the beginning for those of us that, you know, mm-hmm. don't remember that because you do it in every book, that the name that's at the top of the heading of the chapter, that's who we're hearing the story from. And that makes for really interesting, again, really, really interesting reading. Oh, this is Tatum talking now. Mm-hmm. Okay. You
know? That's the psychologist in me. That's what, because I'm really interested in how people think. And that's the only way I'm interested in writing. As you know, actually, when I first wrote, I sent this to an editor, my book, and she says, nobody's going to read a book from more than one person's perspective. And I thought, fine, then I'm not going to bother. I'll still write, but I won't bother to try to publish it. Well, then I said, I thought, heck with it. I'm just going to send it to the publisher right away. And then I got picked up by a publisher. And what's funny about it is after a month after I received that letter from the agent, Gone Girl comes out. And that's exactly how it's written. Number one book in the nation. You know, obviously people will read a book from more than one perspective. You know,
yeah.
So one of the challenges I have, and I think every writer does as you bring in characters, is how do you create that unique voice
right.
that is memorably associated with that character?
Right. And so the
psychology that you've studied is enabling you to do that, I'm sure.
Right. And I have an advantage. I think a lot of authors don't have to write mysteries, is that I interview murderers and rapists all the time. So that's easy for me to get that voice. I know how they rationalize their behavior. Like I mentioned in the book, Last Call, even killers are heroes in their own stories. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, this is so much fun.
It is.
Kind of looking at time. We're going to step away again for a moment, and we're going to share with you about one of the places you can order the books of many of our guest authors, and that's the Out West Shop affiliate page on bookshop.org. And then that is going to be followed immediately by another one of our sponsors, and that's Jim and me with our online business, outwestshop.com. And when we come back, we're going to find out from Richard and Frank, what are they working on next and how you can stay in touch with them. We'll be right back. Don't go away. Story is everything. Find a great one on Out West Shop's bookshop. Go to outwestshop.com, find books and CDs on the menu, choose Shop Out West on bookshop.org. Browse through featured authors on Rendezvous with a Writer. Explore curated book lists and our featured picks. Add in note cards, calendars, and jigsaw puzzles. One-stop shopping for great gifts. Use the search box to find thousands more titles. Make the switch. Your purchase supports us as independent booksellers. That's our story.
Here at the Out West Shop, we're passionate about the American West. The truth and the myth. We're purveyors of fine Western goods. We scout for unique and distinctive apparel, accessories, home decor, and general merchandise that are a reflection of the Western lifestyle. We hunt for unique artisans and craftsmen who are inspired to create decorative art you can wear based on their own love for the story of the West. We round it up and bring it to you. Check out OutWestShop.com when you need anything Western.
Welcome back to Rendezvous with the Writer, Richard Sherry and Frank Weber. Richard, where can we find you?
I am at Richard Sherry Author, all one word, on Facebook. And I occasionally post pieces about writing there. My books, I have to say with some chagrin, are only available on Amazon, both paperback and Kindle. So you can get electronic copies if you want as well. I wish I were in bookstores, but that's coming.
Yeah, sure.
Very good.
And what are you working on next? Or maybe tell us the titles again of the books in the series.
Well, first we got A Month of Sundays, then Mondays, which is about the Supreme Court. And then First Tuesday, which is about the election last fall. And this one ends surprisingly, and it leads us into the one I'm working on right now, Wednesday. The inauguration, everybody knows, was on Monday, January 20th. And so I think it's chapter 3. We find out what happens on Wednesday after Monday.
And yeah. Jim has a quote, I think.
Yeah, we take a quote from Richard from your book. And we're talking about one of Dr. Baker's students, Justin Ross. He's been interviewed by an investigator by the name of Devin Cook. And she's asking for some details. And she says, what did Dr. Baker suggest you do? And he quoted something he used to say in class. He said that the most important reason to leave your job wasn't whether or not you could get paid better or advance faster. It was when your job forced you to be unethical or compromise your core values.
Richard, thank you for being with us. And don't go away. Stay right there. All right, Frank, on to you. So, of course, tonight we talked about The Sun, which was the sequel to Scandal of Vandals. And now tell us, what do you got coming up next and where can people find you?
So I'm writing a book called Heartbreak Hollow. And what's interesting, I became interested in a case. I got a lot of information on a case about a woman who was assaulted and left in the woods. And what intrigued me about it is she heard a dog barking. And she realized, okay, a dog would be close to a house. So she kept following it and in very bad shape and makes it there. And interestingly enough, later finds out there was no dog. And that's true to the case. Which is interesting. Yeah. And
you got me.
And there's a number of things involved. And then I got thinking about it because I dabble a little with that relationship. Roan's son, Lorenzo, who's he's I don't know how to describe him, very self-centered, not malicious, just self-centered and egotistical kind of person, you know, maybe a little malicious. And so he's in a relationship with this Eliana. And then I thought about, okay, what if Eliana was the victim in this one?
Oh.
Right. And so you get to look at how that relationship gets hammered at. And so I would like this story. I'm excited about it. And it's at the editor right now is looking at it. She says, I think this is your best book. So.
Oh, wow. And where can people find you and get your books?
So frankweberauthor.com. You can get me on a lot of bookstores and Barnes & Noble and Amazon, and they're on audio on also on Amazon also. But if you want to go to frankweberauthor.com, I do blog on some cases sometimes and enjoy talking about a variety of different forensic things.
All right, Frank, we have a quote. I'm looking at time now. Ooh, we have a quote.
Yeah, do it quick. Our main character, John Frederick, is speaking with Ricky Day, which we mentioned before, a convicted murderer out on parole. And John says, no one has felt pain like I have, but it evidently ends. It eventually ends, and life goes on. And he says, Charles Dickens wrote, I have been bent and broken, but I hope into a better shape. Mm-hmm. And Ricky says, I need to think about that. Mm-hmm. What was the name of the book? And John says, Great Expectations. To which Ricky says, If it were written about me, it would have been titled No Expectations.
Well, gentlemen, thank you so much for being with us tonight. This is episode 126. If you go out looking for it, next week, Kevin Wolf comes on back. He was with us with his book, Trail Ridge, a few months ago. Now we'll be talking with Kevin about the boot heel, and that's next week. And I think we're out of time. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thanks, Jim and Bobby. Nice meeting you, Richard.
We'll see you down the road. Always a great day.
Out west. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Take care. Goodbye.